This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Good afternoon. Dr. Everett Piper, president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University in Bartlesville, Oklahoma, filling in for Tony Perkins this afternoon. An early Merry Christmas to you. We have an exciting program this afternoon. Let me set the stage, do a little housekeeping here, and set the agenda for the next hour. At the top of the hour, we are going to be joined by Derek Cohen, the Deputy Director for the Center for Effective Justice at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. And we're going to talk to Derek, or he's going to talk to us, about President Obama's pardons and the record-setting commutations that he is giving to criminals. We're going to talk to Derek about why we should or should not be concerned about that, and he'll lead us through that particular issue. As we turn to the quarter of the hour, we're going to talk about Michelle Obama's recent statement on the Oprah Winfrey show about the loss of hope that the American people are suffering as a result of Donald Trump's election. Dran Reese will be with us from the Salt and Light Council to discuss that. As we go to the bottom of the hour, I'm going to play an audio clip. A video wouldn't do you much good, seeing as this is a radio program. I'm going to play an audio clip for you. A deathbed statement by a Marine, Larry Lindsley, who was thanking Donald Trump and Vice President-elect Pence and saying how proud he is with regard to the contribution that he had in the election and whatnot. We're going to play that clip and then discuss the election, Donald Trump, and Vice President Pence, and some of the issues that Christians are wrestling with as the result of this particular debate that we're having in our culture, even after the election. We all know it took place before the election. It obviously is taking place even now within the church and within the broader culture. So with that as the intro, looking forward to having you join us today with your calls. I'll give you that number before I set the stage for Derek Cohen to join us. The call-in number is 866-372-7234, 866-372-7234. We'll probably wait until the bottom of the hour or thereabout to start receiving your calls, but I welcome the opportunity to have dialogue and conversation with you today. With that said, I'm going to ask Derek Cohen to join me on the line. I assume you're there and ready to go, Derek.
Yes, sir. Glad to be here.
Oh, honored to have you. I'm going to reintroduce you here. You're the director for the Center for Effective Justice at the Texas Public Policy Foundation, correct?
Correct. We are a 501c3 think tank in Austin, fighting the good fight in session and in the federal level as well.
Now, before we get into Barack Obama's pardons and the various different commuted sentences that he's given, and he continues to give as he gets ready to exit the presidency, a little bit more about the Texas Public Policy Foundation. I assume you deal with a variety of different issues, a variety of different topics, and you're just one person within the foundation, and you deal specifically with justice issues and legal issues?
Yes, sir, that is correct. We are about 50 people strong overall, and our policy center, or should I say our policy centers, enumerate areas such as education reform, economic freedom, fiscal responsibility, higher education, constitutional principles, basically any part where conservative values can be seen through public policy. We have a center that focuses on that.
Give a website so I don't forget at the end of this segment. So if people want to follow you or your Twitter feed or whatever, what contact information?
Certainly. TPPF generally is texaspolicy.com, and us at Right on Crime doing the conservative criminal justice work can be followed at rightoncrime.com.
Okay. All right. Great. Well, with that laundry done, let's get to the topic here. Why should we care about Barack Obama setting records in terms of sentences commuted as well as pardons granted? As I was reading today, and I'm sure you'll give us more, perhaps even more accurate data, he has commuted 1,176 sentences thus far, And the highest number, even the second highest number of any president, is slightly over 200 by President Johnson. It drops down to less than 100 for President Clinton. So Obama is going crazy in commuting sentences and pardoning people. Why, and why should we care?
Well, that's two distinct questions there, and I'm glad you asked. The pardon question in and of itself is a bit of a mixed bag. Barack Obama's pardons are actually amongst the lowest, next to George H.W. Bush, which is only about 74. Again, he was only in office one term. President Obama's was 148. But you rightly call attention to the issue of commutations, which, you know, far, when taken in tandem with the pardons, far dwarf any president going back towards Eisenhower. And so the issue that this brings up is you have an issue of legitimacy. Now, is the pardon commutation power legitimate? It certainly
can,
is.
Can I interrupt real quick?
Sure.
What's the difference between a pardon and a commutation?
Well, without going too far into the weeds, the best way I could sum that up is saying a pardon is essentially absolving somebody of a crime, whereas a commutation is downgrading the actual sanction without actually passing any determination on the guilt.
Okay. With that clarification, go ahead then.
Certainly, certainly. And so the commutations, you know, Barack Obama had commuted more than, multiples more than any other president. The problem is one of legitimacy. Now, both the commutations and the pardons are both enshrined in the Constitution as powers of the president. No one's arguing that. The problem is, and the problem that most people have with the Obama administration thus far, is his use of executive action to get around Congress, if you will. You know, we saw this exact same instance in the immigration debate. You know, this is the pen and the phone all over again, just to a different standard. Now, I do have to point out that with the commutations in general, many of which, if they were sentenced today, would have a sentence that looks similar to the one they were commuted to. So in other words, you know, these are having a lot of political fanfare. You know, I think on the left, these things are being very well received. But it tends to not actually bring about the reform that he's purportedly looking for. And the big problem is, again, it gets around the legislature and around legislative prerogative.
And am I correct in suggesting it also gets around the judicial branch, because you're commuting a sentence that has been legitimized through a court of law, through a jury, and the sentence was given by a judge, and now it's being commuted by the President of the United States. In other words, the executive is deciding to ignore the judicial branch, ignore the legislative branch, and do what he wants. Am I exaggerating that point?
No, you're not. I would put a caveat on that, though. It's not entirely sidestepping the judicial element. One example in particular, an individual who received one of these commutations was sentenced, and it just happened to be a happenstance of fate with the weird mechanisms of our mandatory minimum laws. You know, the gentleman named Weldon Angelos, was found selling marijuana once. You know, with a, and then was alleged to have sold it twice more to a confidential informant. Although the record on that is sketchy, the judge in that case actually was bound by law to give him 55 years. And having the 55 years, you know, the judge that sentenced, he's like, look, I'd like to impose a more commensurate sentence. Now you need to be punished for this, but definitely not at the cost of 55 years. So that was actually one where the commutation was used probably to bring the sentence more in line with justice. Now the problem is, you'd basically, could we justify that for 1,176 of them? I think that would not be. I don't think you can extrapolate that logic.
Is there a political theme or a common thread that runs through these 1,000 plus commutations that we should be aware of?
I would have to say, and again, I have not been able to review all of them, but the vast majority of those that I've seen are all related to drug cases, most of which are subject to mandatory minimums. And then again, the mandatory minimum setup that we have in today's current sentencing scheme, it's not perfect, and it could use an element of reform. Are there 1,176 people worthy of this? That's more of an arcane question there. But the actual theme, or the thread to answer your question, I think, would be, yes, these are mostly drug offenses. Some of them are drug offenses with firearms charges as well, and that's where we start seeing people tend to get a little reticent about issuing these, or should I say reticent about supporting these is because these individuals have firearm charges on them as well.
So our president, who has been perhaps, at least in recent memory, the most anti-gun president that we've had, a lot of people who believe in the Second Amendment have been scared to death that it would be compromised under Barack Obama's leadership. And the Supreme Court, had he been allowed to appoint Scalia's replacement, indeed we could have suffered great loss there. At least a lot of people would argue that. Perhaps you agree or disagree. But the president, the president we're afraid of when it comes to our Second Amendment rights is actually commuting the sentences of violent criminals that have gun offenses?
Yeah, that's true. I believe the stat I saw on the last round of commutations was 46 had a firearm enhancement or a firearm state predicate in there, basically saying that a firearm was a non-trivial element of the fact pattern of the crime. Now, in and of itself, what that means in what actually played out doesn't tend to be the same from case to case, but at the very least, that is something that when you look at the legislative discussion on this, there has been a general reticence to offer any sort of safety valve or any sort of clemency to individuals that use firearms in the furtherance of substance abuse crimes. And I definitely think that with that, that is the most direct sidestepping of the legislative prerogative on this.
All right, I'm going to get back to the number here because I can't get off of it. He's got 1,176 commutations compared to the highest number of commutations, as I read it, would be President Johnson, slightly over 200. Mm-hmm. There has to be a reason that you've exceeded Johnson's record by nearly 1,000, and it has to be ideologically driven. Now, I'm going to go back. I've already asked you the question. Not that you didn't answer me, but I want to dig a little bit deeper here.
Sure.
Why? Do you have any theory as to why?
Well, if I were to posit a guess, we definitely seen this administration, be strong in the the criminal justice reform rhetoric, and in certain circles on the left, that does bear a lot of fruit. The only problem is, not to be cynical, but with most things on the left, there's no properly specified policy prescription for this. It's one of these abstract notions of racial justice and social justice, but it doesn't have an ear towards public safety. It doesn't have an ear towards government efficiency of government overreach even, and so it tends to just kind of be a ham-fisted proposal. And I think that was articulated best by Senator Cornyn when he's seen these. And Senator Cornyn is a big champion of criminal justice reform. But even he looked at these and said, this is not the way to get it done. This is sidestepping the legislative prerogative, and we definitely need to make sure that all voices that we bring out in the legislative process are being heard. So I would say that there's probably a cynical political calculus here.
I think we probably have around 60 seconds or thereabout left in this segment, so I'll ask you this question. What I think I just heard you say was that there's an ideological impetus behind this, and I'm going to have to be quick here. I do hear the music coming on. But is this being driven by race and ideology as much as it is safety?
I can't say how much it's being driven by the former two. I can just say that there hasn't been any creed paid to safety thus far.
Okay. Great. Thanks so much for joining us, and Merry Christmas to you, Derek.
Merry Christmas, Dr. Piper.
All right. This is Dr. Everett Piper sitting in for Tony Perkins. We're going to take a commercial break right now. If you want to call in, it's 866-372-7234. We'll start taking your calls at the bottom of the hour. Coming up next, we'll talk about Michelle Obama's bemoaning of the loss of hope, and Dran Reese will join us from Salt Lake Council to lead us through that particular issue.
Every day, more schools around the country are giving in to the transgender agenda. Boys claiming to be female are already being allowed into girls' bathrooms and locker rooms. What can parents do to stop this disturbing trend from spreading to their children's schools? Family Research Council is now offering a new resource to help. A Parent's Guide to the Transgender Movement in Education is a concise brochure that can be downloaded at frc.org/gender. To order hard copies, call 800-225-4008. You'll learn valuable tips on how to talk to your children, their teachers, school board members, neighbors, and fellow churchgoers, and the steps you can take to prevent the advancement of the transgender agenda in your school. Again, the number is 800-225-4008. 4008 to request this brochure. Your gift of just $5 will cover the cost of shipping and handling, and additional copies are available for $1. Thank you for standing strong for the family.
This is a Decency Minute. I'm Bill Johnson. In all that we do, do it in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. All includes the words we speak, the food we eat, and the clothes we wear. Whether it's pride or rebellion, modesty is a battle in the world and the church. How can a Christian point others to God while drawing attention to themselves? Modest clothing draws the eye not to the outer body, but to the light of Christ within. Ayesha Curry, wife of NBA star Stephen Curry, tweeted, "Everyone's into barely wearing clothes these days, huh? Not my style. I like to keep the good stuff covered up for the one who matters," unquote. Certainly, she was referring to her husband, but as a professed Christian, she may have had Jesus in mind, too. Remember, choose your clothes to the glory of God. This is a Decency Minute. Find us at AmericanDecency.org. I'm Bill Johnson.
We've always had an interest. God has given us a gift of being able to help a lot of people with their finances and budgets and stuff.
AFA supporters Bernie and Alice Larson met Dan Celia at a Faith, Family, and Finance town hall meeting.
And he answered some questions, and we were thinking about the charitable gift annuities, and we'd never heard of that before, but we thought, well, we'd always wanted to leave some of our money for God, but we didn't know where or how. And we felt like this was put into our laps as answer to our prayers as to what we could do after we're gone.
Bernie and Alice learned a charitable gift annuity from the AFA Foundation would provide them with a monthly income for life, as well as supporting the American Family Association into the future. You can learn more about charitable gift annuities and other financial products at afafoundation.net or call 800-326-4543, extension 345.
And you just can't outgive God.
And welcome back. Dr. Everett Piper here, president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University, sitting in for Tony Perkins this afternoon. We may have to adjust a little bit in this segment. We're trying to get a hold of Dran Rees to talk about Michelle Obama's comments with regard to our culture losing its hope. So I will ad lib here a little bit while we try to track down Dran Rees. This is actually something that is hot on my radar also. In 2008, when Barack Obama chose the campaign slogan, Hope and Change, I thought personally that it was a brilliant campaign slogan for a postmodern culture. Now, what do I mean by that? Does it mean that I agreed with Barack Obama's campaign and the end result? Absolutely not. But as a marketing strategy, choosing the campaign slogan, Hope and Change, I think was incredibly shrewd by Barack Obama and the Democratic Party in 2008. Here's why. What does hope and change mean? Define it for me. What do those two words mean? I would argue that they mean very little until you tell me what you are hoping for and what change you seek. I thought time and time again during that campaign, when Barack Obama and the Democratic Party would flout and champion the words hope and change, that somebody needed to step forward in radio, on TV, in the political debates and say, what is it that you're hoping for and what do you seek to change? You see, I would argue that those two words are essentially meaningless. They're empty of definition until you add those clarifying components to the words. In other words, here's what I'm saying. Imagine an empty glass. That glass can hold anything. You could pour water in it, and it would nourish you and quench your thirst. You could pour vinegar in it, and it would be bitter, and you probably would not want to consume much of it. You could pour poison in the glass, and it would kill you. You see, hope and change, in my view, are like empty glasses. They mean very little until you pour definition, until you pour meaning into them. And it's only when you pour meaning into the glass of change that you know what that is and whether you want to consume it or not. You know whether it's water and it will keep you healthy, or rather it's poison, and it will lead to your death. You need to know what's been poured into the glass of change. Likewise, you need to know what's been poured into the glass of hope. Otherwise, you could be hoping for something very evil and diabolical, or you could be hoping for something very selfish and narcissistic, or you could be hoping for something grand and glorious that's grounded in a biblical worldview and the time-tested truths of God and culture. That's why this whole debate right now about hope, I think, is very pertinent to our culture and our time. So, when Michelle Obama goes on the Oprah Winfrey Show and bemoans the loss of hope, Oprah needs to ask her, and we need to ask her, what do you mean by that? Hoping for what? Hoping for more freedom, more constitutional liberties, more free enterprise, more religious liberty and more religious freedom, more ideological and intellectual freedom on the college campuses, more true tolerance as opposed to the fake tolerance of the postmodern culture that wants to shut down any ideas that they find intolerable? What is it that you're hoping for? If you're hoping for more socialism versus more capitalism, I may disagree with you. If you're hoping for less liberty rather than more freedom, I may disagree with you. You see, the issue here is, after the election, those that wanted more freedom, those that wanted the protection of the Constitution, those that wanted to celebrate capitalism and free enterprise, those that wanted to celebrate and pursue constitutional liberties are actually finding themselves in a position of feeling more hopeful right now. But yet, Michelle Obama feels that the culture has lost hope. Why? It's because of the subjective agenda that Michelle Obama has. It's because of the bifurcation of our culture. If you want big government, then you've lost hope because your hope was in that. If you want more God than you want government, perhaps today you're finding a little bit of a spring in your step and you are a little bit more hopeful rather than less. So when Michelle Obama bemoans the loss of hope, I think somebody ought to be asking her, hoping for what? What is it that you were hoping for? Just like I wanted somebody to ask Barack Obama in 2008, change what? What is it that you want to change? If you want to change our Constitution, if you want to change our religious liberties, if you want to change the First Amendment, if you want to change the Second Amendment, if you want to change the Supreme Court, if you want to change the definition of what it means to be male, if you want to change the definition of what it means to be female, if you want to change the whole idea of gender, if you want to change the church's time-tested truths, the sacrament of marriage, then please tell us now that that's your definition of change and that is what you're going to pour in the glass of change. Because if that's what's in it, there are a lot of us out there that don't want to drink it. The same questions need to be asked today when the Democrats and the left and the progressives and the postmoderns start bemoaning the loss of hope. Because what is it that you've lost hope for? If you've lost hope because there isn't enough socialism, if you've lost hope because there isn't enough big government, if you've lost hope because the deplorables out there are celebrating and worshiping God more than the power base in Washington, D.C., if you've lost hope because people actually may be able to celebrate their religious convictions without feeling the fear of the federal government penalizing them, fining them, sequestering them, and silencing them, if you've lost hope because Christian colleges such as mine can now go out there and celebrate their Christianity without fear of being shut down and losing their tax-exempt status and being penalized by the Department of Education and the Office of Civil Rights because I will not accommodate transgender bathrooms and transgender football teams and basketball teams and soccer teams on my campus, then perhaps what we're hoping for as Christians has actually been revived and rekindled. This is Dr. Everett Piper. I'm president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University in Bartlesville, Oklahoma. And what I want to do as we go into this break is remind you that my Twitter is Dr. Everett Piper. That's D-R-E-V-E-R-E-T-T if you want to follow me. D-R-E-V-E-R-E-T-T. And if you want to follow Tony, his is T. Perkins. T. Perkins. You can follow FRC.org or you can go to Oklahoma Wesleyan University. That's www.okwu.edu. Time for a commercial break. Be right back in a couple minutes.
Making the most of your money. Here's Dan Celia.
Well, the Dow Industrials flirt with a 20,000-point level. We'll see if this goes. It looks like traders, institutional investors, are not selling off. They're not taking their profits, and it doesn't look like they're going to. That's something that I said they would be very unlikely to do this year, as they've had a long, rough year, and they want to continue to keep portfolios propped up, and that's exactly what we are seeing. The dollar is drifting lower after the dollar has hit a 14-year high. It is slipping off of that against the yen and the euro. So this is good for what? Gold prices. Yes. So gold prices finally starting to get a little bit of a bump up. I don't think it's anything to get too awfully excited about. And it is not likely that gold prices are going to get near $1,200 an ounce before the end of the year. We'll have to wait and see. We are getting a little bit of economic news coming out. The rest of this week, we get existing home sales. We get that third quarter GDP look. Durable good orders are coming out. A very important number. We'll talk about that later in the week. And we get personal income and personal spending. So we'll watch those things. Very, very important. By the way, General Motors has announced 1,600 workers are being laid off in three factories. And I would expect that count to go up. As when you look at the report and what is happening in General Motors, they are starting to struggle. And remember, General Motors and their sweet deal hasn't paid any taxes for the last 8 years, but they're 2 years away from needing to. And I think they're going to finally start rethinking their 40 years of mismanagement.
Want to hear more financial advice from Dan Celia? Then look for his podcast when you visit the website afr.net.
Dr. Everett Piper, president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University, sitting in this afternoon on Washington Watch for Tony Perkins. Call-in number is 866-372-7234, 866-372-7234, and an early Merry Christmas to everyone. As you know, in the previous segment, I ad-libbed a little bit because we were searching for Dran Rees, who was going to join us and help us sort through this issue of the loss of hope that Michelle Obama is bemoaning. I believe we have Dran with us right now. Dran, are you there?
I am, Dr. Piper. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. It's good to have you. I don't know if you heard me in my comments on hope or not, but as we prepare to give you an opportunity to discuss this issue, I'd like to ask the producers back there to cue up Michelle Obama's actual audio. Go ahead and cue that up, please.
Now we're feeling what not having hope feels like, you know. Hope is necessary. It's a necessary concept.
So hope is necessary, and now we feel what it's like to lose it, essentially, is what Michelle Obama is saying. Dran, how do you respond to this?
I have to say my very first gut reaction to that was, how arrogant. They think so highly of themselves as the saviors of our country that they're the only ones that can dispense hope. When Obama was elected to office, there was a whole other faction of the United States of America that went into hopelessness. So I think there's a two-way street here. It kind of ebbs and flows with each election.
Absolutely, and I went on a bit of a rant prior to the commercial break, and I said, hoping for what? I mean, if you're a flower shop owner or a pizza shop owner or a photographer or a calligrapher who's suffering the loss of your company because you've lost hope that the federal government has any common sense and any sense of fairness and any respect for the constitutional rights that we should have to celebrate and practice our religious convictions without impediment from the federal government or penalty, then we have been living in a sense of in a state of hopelessness, if you will, because we've been looking over our shoulder at every turn, waiting for the next shoe to drop.
Well, I think the honeymoon is over. When President Obama was elected to office, all of us on the other side, we you know, we took our lumps. It was a bitter pill to swallow, but we did it, and we went away quietly, and we hoped, for America's sake, that this historic moment for the first black president was going, we started to root for him. We really wanted to root for him. I know I certainly did. But then a few things started to happen. Michelle Obama said, well, this is the first time that I finally am proud to be an American. What? The first time in your life. So we started to see these little glimpses in the administration of what was to come. And then, of course, we were introduced to their pastor that damned America instead of blessed America.
Mm-hmm,
so for all of us on the other side, we started to see what we were willing to accept as, okay, our bitter pill, and then get on board. We started to feel hopelessness, and just as you say, it continued to snowball into some of the issues that you're talking about.
Absolutely, and as a president of a Christian college that has stood in the face of the storm, and I've said no to the transgender mandates, the accommodation of transgender bathrooms, I've said no to the abortion abortifacient mandates in the Health and Human Services and the Obamacare issue, I've said no to a variety of things, but I actually felt a sense of desperation as we went into this election, because if Hillary Clinton would have won, I literally think it could have been the end of Christian colleges that were going to remain true to their orthodoxy and their biblical faith. And if we said, no, we will not compromise, we were afraid that the Department of Education or the Office of Civil Rights would actually put us out of business by making our actions and our mission statements illegal within the state. Within the United States. So there was definitely a sense of hopelessness, if you will, on my side of the fence.
Well, I can sure sense that, Dr. Piper, certainly in your educational institution, and of course we had that problem out here in California, where they are trying to go after the Christian schools out here, where they can you have to post what your beliefs are, and government-funded programs for the kids would have to be removed if we didn't support transgender bathrooms.
Exactly.
So it's all over the place, and I totally agree with you. I think that many of us sense that America was headed down an immoral slide so fast that if we weren't able to stop this, this would be the end of America. And frankly, you know, President Obama actually said that again in his earlier statements when you and I both know that the operating system of America is Judeo-Christian. That's the operating system. And he came out with that statement that said, we're no longer a Christian nation, but a nation of Muslims and Buddhists, etc., whatever that statement was. And I have to say, I took real offense to that, and so did a lot of people. So I
Absolutely.
Think over time, President Obama has shown his true colors. He really, in my opinion, is not a true American under the principles that this country was founded.
And as I said in the previous segment, when somebody speaks of hope and change, they need to define what they mean by those words. Hope for what? And what do you seek to change? And until they define those things, we really don't know whether to celebrate that hope or be afraid of it, or to participate in the change or try to stop it. Dran, thank you so much for joining us today. A Merry Christmas to you, and I wish you all the best out there in California and Salt and Light Council. And folks, we'll be right back after this commercial break, and we're going to listen to a audio with regard to Larry Lindsay, the Marine, who on his deathbed celebrated and gave thanks to Donald Trump and Mike Pence.
Your American Family Association will never quit.
We will never quit, ever.
We will continue to stand for God's truth as long as we have breath and the religious liberty to do so.
We believe that God might still show mercy to America by sending revival.
So we will continue to be salt and light in our nation.
Thank you for standing with the American Family Association this year through your prayers, your financial partnership, and your determination to be salt and light where you live. In the days ahead, we ask for your continued involvement so that as battles arise, your American Family Association will be here to fight for your family, fight for America.
Let me tell you something. All God asks of you is faithfulness. That's it.
Today, when you give $35 or more, we'll send you the new book, Our Call to Faithfulness, The Voice and Legacy of Don Wildman. Visit afa.net/faithfulness.
Consider serving the Lord with friendships. It's an opportunity to reach out to the needy around the world. They're now taking applications to volunteer, and they need help in the areas of mechanics, maritime, including deck, engine, and steward departments, food service, warehousing, and office. Check it out at friendships.org or call 337-433-5022.
Dysfunction in Washington is not the problem. The real issue is a lack of leadership.
When it comes to economic policy, our government seems to be out of control, and Christians could have a role in restoring it.
Christians will change the direction of America if we step up.
Visit afastore.net to find the DVD Surviving Government Economic Policies with Dan Celia, as well as all the resources of the AFA Cultural Institute.
Merry Christmas from 8 Days of Hope. We want to thank you, the American Family Radio listener, for supporting 8 Days of Hope as we serve disaster victims in 2016. Volunteers from across the country that heard about 8 Days of Hope on AFR came to Texas and Louisiana, and South Carolina and West Virginia to help out flood victims. You came to Mississippi to help out flood victims and tornado victims. And then in October, we happened to be in South Carolina where Hurricane Matthew hit. And we had thousands of people there that were willing to help and serve and love others who needed our assistance. Thank you for your volunteering. Thank you for your financial support. But most of all, thank you for your prayers for 8 Days of Hope. Please continue to pray for 8 Days of Hope as we move to 2017. We hope that you and your family have a Merry Christmas and a joyous new year.
That's Steve Tiber of 8 Days of Hope, a ministry partner of the American Family Association. You can learn more at 8daysofhope.com.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire. Jack Frost nipping at your nose.
Dr. Everett Piper from Oklahoma Wesleyan University, you sitting in this afternoon for Tony Perkins on Washington Watch. Thank you all for joining us today. The call-in number, if you wish to have any conversation here in the last 15 minutes, is 866-372-7234, 866-372-7234. I don't have any guests in the last 15 minutes. We're going to start out with the story of Dr. Larry Lindsay, a former Marine who delivered a very moving message. You need to get your Kleenex ready if you haven't heard this one yet. From his deathbed, he literally died very short time after this message. Larry fought to stay alive to make sure that he was able to vote in this last election because he was afraid that the America he had fought for and the America that he had served was on its deathbed. And as he suffered through every breath, as you'll be able to hear in this audio, he is expressing his thanks and his pride in the election. Listen to me with, if you will, to Larry Lindsay.
President Trump, Vice President Pence, and General Mattis, I would like to say that the greatest honor of my life has been to wage this battle with you. I have been prouder of being a Marine than anything I have ever done in my life. Having a hand in some small way in fighting for my country has meant the world to me. There is no greater honor for me to have great men like you leading this country back to its foundation and back to God. President Trump, I have no doubt in my heart and in my mind that you will be perhaps the greatest president in the history of our country. Vice President Pence, I am so honored to call you my vice president. You're an incredibly good man and probably the only vice president in 150 years to have any brains. And I appreciate that about you. The candor and your honesty from both of you men is much needed in this day and time. General Mattis, sir, it appears that I am now out of ammunition, but I continue to fight with my last breath. I do not fear death because I know where I'm going, and I'm only going home for a rest. It's you people here, the good people of America, for whom I cry, my loved ones and my friends, and the sacrifices they must continue to make in this fight to restore our country. Dying is the easy part. Dying is the comforting part if you know who your God is and you know that He holds your hand. And I do. I praise God for a wonderful life. So many wonderful blessings that I have known. And so many wonderfully kind and loving people in this country whom I have met during my fight for this country. I want you to know, each and every one of you, that we have taken on a challenge that has only just begun. The real battle lies ahead. And General Mattis, I have one request, sir, and that is, give them and simplify. God bless.
Wow, what a testimony. What a testimony. Larry's last words, bittersweet. He died a few hours after this message, and he went to his eternal rest, knowing America was in different hands, in his view, good hands. But he also realized that the fight is just beginning, and he's right. The fight for freedom is ongoing. As Ronald Reagan told us, freedom is but one generation away from death. We need to preserve it, defend it, define it. And if we don't, it's lost. And our children and our grandchildren will hear of stories of what it meant to live free, but they won't enjoy it as we have and as Larry did. Very grateful for his testimony, and I wanted you to hear the whole thing. It was a bit lengthy, but I wanted you to hear what he had to say. I'm going to conclude this particular segment with my own view on the Trump election. But before I do that, I've got one caller waiting for me right now. He's from Alabama, I believe, and I'm trying to remember your name. Is it Willard? Willard, would you join us, please?
Leonard.
Leonard. Sorry, Leonard. Yeah, Merry Christmas to you.
Okay. My question seems insignificant after listening to Larry. I was deeply moved by his video that he had on Facebook. I had seen it there, but listening to it on the radio is moving again. So I'll be quick. I was watching Fox News today, and I saw where President Obama had signed an order placing millions of acres of Bering Sea off limits to
right
to drilling, and the report was that he had done this permanently. And my question is, how can he sign an order to permanently ban anything as an executive order? I thought it could be overturned by the incoming president.
Okay, good question, Leonard. The little bit of reading I did on this story today would lend me to give you this answer. Whether or not the succeeding president can reverse this particular decision is up for grabs. Much of what I read today said that Donald Trump or any other succeeding president could not overrule this particular issue. Now, why, I don't know, because an executive order by one president presumably can be changed via an executive order by the following president. And we've read a lot about this in terms of many of the executive orders and bureaucratic edicts that have been issued that have circumvented and been in runs around the legislative process are reversible. From Obamacare to some of the other transgender issues and whatnot, transgender bathrooms and bathroom bills and all this nonsense, that the next president can overrule those. Why this particular thing can't be overruled, I don't know. I'm not an attorney. We'd have to do some more reading on this. But what I did also learn today is that the Congress does have the authority to do something about this. So I think your concern is legitimate, and I think your question is spot on. Is this permanent or not? And the answer is no, it's not permanent if Congress chooses to take legislative action and to do its job in terms of creating law and defining law. And it could do that in this case and thus overrule Barack Obama's executive order, as I understand it. I think a key question in this is, what are our priorities? We know that today, and how many years, it wasn't that many years ago, it was a handful of years ago, 10, 12 at most, where we were bemoaning the fact that we were going to be dependent for perpetuity, forever, on the Middle East for our energy supply. And nobody thought that it was possible for the United States to be energy independent. And anybody who suggested that was laughed at. And here we are today, and I'm in Oklahoma, so I'm in the middle of the energy industry. Here we are in our culture today where we have over 100 years supply of natural gas to run our entire nation, our auto fleet, our transportation, as well as our heating and energy demands would be met simply by a 100 year supply of natural gas that lies underneath the Great Plains and the Bakken Reserve and whatnot. We know that. That's a fact. It's not speculation. And when we could wean ourselves from the dependence on countries that actually hate us and don't want us to enjoy our constitutional liberties, they want to see our demise. They believe that Sharia law is a better form of government and legal definition for how a culture and a people should live in compliance with one another than a constitutional republic. When we know that we can preserve our own dignity and our own freedoms and our own independence through our own energy supply, but yet we're signing it off and refusing to exploit it, you have to wonder why in the world we would do that. I understand our obligation as Christians to steward our environment and to be responsible for the creation that God has given us. But we also know that in our day and time that it's very possible to do that, be good stewards, take care of our environment, but still exploit the natural resources that are available to us. It's an ideological agenda driven by the philosophy and the theory of man caused global warming and climate change, and it totally ignores the responsibility we have for our own defense and our own sustenance that we could generate under our own territory and within our own boundaries. I'd like to go back to the issue of Donald Trump and wrap up the program with that. I wrote an article a couple weeks ago, and I titled it, "This is Why They Voted for Trump," and I want to read this as perhaps a salute to Larry Lindsey. Tori Sanders, in her recent article, "Hate Didn't Elect Donald Trump, People Did," suggests The result of last week's, this was written right after the election, last week's presidential election did not expose a red shout of racism, but rather a red shout of help. She goes on to argue that to write this off as simple racism is to ignore the very real and very heartbreaking struggles small-town Americans face. Sanders then concludes, even if you do not believe Trump will follow through on his promises, he was still the one of only a few politicians who focused on rural communities and said, I see you, I hear you, and I want to help you, and I will not ignore you, and I will not insult you. In response, these voters came out for the candidate who listened to them and offered to, quote-unquote, make America great again. Well, my family background is not all that unlike what Sanders describes. I understand and I agree. If this election proves anything, it is this. Working-class Americans have been mocked, maligned, and forgotten long enough. They are fed up, and they went out to the voting booth last week and said so. This election's red state vote had little to do with racism or phobias. The message I heard, the message we heard during this election, was rather a simple and clear plea for the average, from the average blue-collar, small-town mother and father from Washington and other big city elites to stop belittling, disparaging, and vilifying us and our families. It was our way of telling the know-it-alls, the politicians and the pundits, to stop flying over and driving past our gutted factories and our dying towns and pretending we don't exist and we don't matter. We simply wanted the smarter and the more educated city liberals to know that we are tired of the insults and that the condescension needs to stop. We voted for Trump because someone finally appeared to care and listen. We voted for Trump because he seemed to get it. Finally, someone seemed to understand that the average guy, the plumber, the carpenter, the truck driver, the farmer, the good and decent family man from Dewey, Oklahoma, or from Hillsdale, Michigan, is the one who is now suffering from more cultural disrespect than perhaps anyone else in all of the country. We voted for Trump because we're sick and tired of being laughed at. We voted for Trump because we have frankly had it with being labeled intolerable by those who claim to be tolerant. We voted for Trump because we think it's deplorable that we are the ones being called deplorables. We voted for Trump because we can't turn on the TV, listen to the radio, or read the newspaper without some highbrow elitist in the mainstream media calling us low-information, uneducated white males who are too dumb to know what's best for us and too stupid to see that Washington knows best. We voted for Trump because all we want to have is a job, get some respect, pick up our paycheck, go to church, raise our kids, and be left alone. This is why. This is the explanation. Hate had nothing to do with it. Love for family, love for farms, love for our towns and our villages and our kids and our community, and yes, even our factories did. That's why we voted for Trump. And the more protests these honest and honorable people, the more protests we see in the streets of New York or the campuses of the Ivory Tower, protests that we rightly see as sanctimonious charades of inclusion that shamelessly exclude us, our voice, our vote, our values, and our very existence, the more us hardworking men and women are going to realize that we were right all along when we went to the ballot box. That's why we voted for Trump. God bless Larry Lindsey's testimony and his departing words and challenge to his country and to its leaders. Merry Christmas. This is Dr. Everett Piper from Oklahoma Wesleyan University filling in for Tony Perkins. Be of courage and fight the good fight. Again, Merry Christmas.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.